I'm going to call the committee to order. We don't have a quorum yet, but I'd like to begin the testimony on House File 589, if we could. We're getting closer to a quorum. But we'll do the minutes and a few other things here a little later. We have possession of this bill, so this is one we will take some action on today. We have a second bill that will be presented by Representative Hansen, hopefully in about 40 to 45 minutes. Did you get that hint, Representative Peterson in committee? 40 to 5 minutes, maybe? We'll hear Hansen's bill. No. If it was controversial, we only had 10 minutes in my committee. So, Representative Peterson, I have been reading a bunch of bill. It looks pretty interesting. I got a chance to see, so I sit on the floor next to you. I hear about a lot of things that you're doing, and I'm interested to hear about them in committee here. So if you'd allow me to... I don't think I can move your bill because we don't have a quorum just yet.
Okay.
But if you could present your testimony, and we'll move it a little bit, because I think you put forth at least one amendment, and there might be another one floating around somewhere.
Just one.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair and members. It's an amendment, A1, 589A1, that would, from what I understand, if counsel could explain, if I get this wrong, is that we're not going to have the rulemaking portion in. Is that correct? Do I have that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Peterson, that's correct. It eliminates all the references to the rulemaking authority for Bowser, the Board of Water and Soil Resources,
mm-hmm.
That were in the bill, and those references are deleted.
Thank you. Then we'll proceed. I've got some folks here then for support, and I will go quickly. This bill deals with biofuels, bioenergy, the next generation. Governor Plenty has made statements, and others have made statements, and the U.S. Department of the Energy Policy Act in 2006 will mandate 250 million gallons of cellulosic ethanol by 2013. So that's the overarching gallons to be had, if you will. So where there's a need for renewables that I've been advocating for, and there's a biofuels opportunity, and we are trying to get policy tools to realize this opportunity. Now, the next one is the national security. Where does our oil come from? Where does it go? You probably are aware of that and have done some reading. Economic issue, the trade deficit. Oil imports cost more than the value of all U.S. ag production, and the volatility, as we've seen with hurricanes. And there's environmental security, the air pollution, and global warming. So we're dependent on oil. It's 40% of our energy, 60% of it is imported, and we peaked back in 1970. In Minnesota, we don't have any oil, we don't have any natural gas, we don't have any coal. But we do have lots of corn, soybeans, and biomass, and other things, and wind, and livestock methane, and such. Biofuels is a proven state economic development tool for corn ethanol. We have 16 plants online, 5 under construction, job impact of $10,000, and from the Department of Agriculture, about $2.7 billion in economic impact. Now, the next part is something maybe members have seen in other committees, and it's the effect, if you will, potential on Minnesota's climate. If we don't take, as some would advocate, we don't take steps to address our behaviors at home. This bill attempts to do that, and it would be a benefit for local owners. Replacing oil, as you can see, is a graph of gasoline demand being reduced through biofuels efficiency and growth patterns. So,
if you just take a second, mm-hmm. We have a quorum, and I will move your bill. I move House File 589, and where did you need to go? Consent calendar?
Environment policy, please.
Recommended to pass and move to environmental policy.
Thank you.
Thank you. And did you want to put on the A1 amendment at this time?
Please, Mr. Chair.
Again, could counsel just explain it and take out the reference to the rulemaking authority in Bowser?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I will move the House amendment, the A1 amendment. Any questions on the A1 amendment? Questions seen none. All those in favor of the Office Amendment A1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. The bill is in the order that you would like it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee. So ethanol is, you have two carbons and a hydroxide, five hydrogens surrounded it. It's intoxicating, if you will. But ethanol is ethanol. Cellulosic or corn simply refers to the feedstock. The corn is a proven technology. Now, cellulosic ethanol, the non-corn, is on the cusp of commercial demonstration, and there's multiple technology platforms to make cellulosic ethanol. In Minnesota, we have an opportunity. We're a leader in ag productivity, strong biofuels industry. We're an innovation leader. Cell ethanol is biofuels, needed to move beyond the limits of grain-based biofuels, and perennial crops in this bill present an opportunity for working lands conservation, water quality improvement, habitat, and recreation while keeping farmland in production. We're not trying to stop raising corn or soybeans in the state of Minnesota. There's some barriers. We got to do some commercialization and developing the new feedstock supplies. And the perennial energy crops, there needs to be some assistance in order to get them started and established, or because they don't necessarily fit traditional farm programs in the state or at the federal level. And then these new crops will require applied on the ground, new equipment and infrastructure for economic profit and delivery, if you will. So we're going for an integrated policy approach, proposing at least a clean energy capital equipment loan, a revolving loan fund for the production and the transport and the storage of the equipment for these crops, and setting a biofuel goal for cellulosic, 25% of the Minnesota 20% ethanol standard. It's approximately 120 million gallons per year, and this is in a quick way of saying it's a local market carve out from the existing Minnesota 20% ethanol standard. And on the biofuel side, there's biofuel side, there's bioenergy side. And some of the testifiers will get to those details. But on the biofuel side, actual liquid, modeling after the successful corn ethanol program, and we're proposing 15 gallons per payment for any ag cellulose, corn stover, wheat straw, those types of things, non-perennial grasses. And then,
did you mean 15 cents per gallon?
15 cents per gallon. What did I say?
I think you said 15 gallons per gallon.
Yeah, thank you. 15 cents per gallon. I know your committee time is limited, so I'm trying to go fast. And then upping it to 30 cents per gallon for 10 years for the perennial crops. And then on the bioenergy side, sort of the gasification and the thermal side, I just described to you what some refer to as the sugar platform or the enzymatic side. This is now the bioenergy, the heat side. 75 cents per million BTU, so heat, for agricultural biomass for 3 years, I believe. And then $1.50 per million BTUs for perennial energy crops for 10 years. So what this does is it offsets natural gas use in some existing ethanol plants, if you will. A couple in the state are starting up, and I think one is running. One proposes to be going this summer in my district. This can be done on a smaller scale, and the opportunities to develop biomass supply systems needed for these cellulosic biorefineries. So continuing on, we need some acres proposed, at least in this version, and using Reinvest in Minnesota. So it would start up what is we're referring to as Reinvest in Minnesota Clean Energy Program. That's $20 million in bonding for the first request. This is an idea that we could leverage some federal money like we do in other areas of the state budget. It's padded on a successful conservation program. I think a lot of people are familiar with RIM. And it applies to acreage enrolled for energy crop production. It's not mandatory. It would be voluntary, and it would be designated for energy crops. Targeted areas coordinated with the energy facility where these feedstocks and masses would need to be delivered to.
And there's the stop just for a quick second. The $20 million for RIM, is that new money, or wasn't there money left that did not get committed?
CREP 2, Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program number 2. which is for the Red River Valley, southeast Minnesota, and the Missouri River watershed in the southwest part of the state. Some are of the thinking that that sign-up is not going, as well as CREP 1 did for the Minnesota River Basin. So, well, we spent CREP 1. Yeah, we can get to, that's a different topic, but thank you for paying attention to this. This is not tied into that.
You are doing it fast, and sometimes it's...
Yep. Yep. Well, I got people getting paid to be here, so I got to let them talk.
There you go.
So, it's pattern we're aware of RIM, and targeted, and the potential to leverage federal farm bill. I think as some are aware, the farm bill is going to be rewritten relatively soon, and the chair of the committee's from Minnesota, and he's talking about an energy title of potentially 5 million acres of energy crops in the next federal farm bill. So we've got this mandate from the feds to say how many gallons there's going to be of cellulose ethanol, and then there's the farm bill that might provide an opportunity for acres for that type of development. It's an integrated policies approach. We're supporting the investment with these players that people have known about and are familiar with, Bowser, PCA, AURI, Agriculture Utilization Research Institute, University of Minnesota, and the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. So, in summary, we're trying to be the state, once again, that is forward-thinking and looking towards the future in terms of diversifying our energy sources, our independence, our local economies, statewide. It's not just a rural Minnesota development bill. And, you know, there's some assistance needed through government intervention to make this viable. And that's, in short, the proposal. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Arnosky for him to explain a little bit more. And then there's a couple after him, so I'll get out of the way and let the committee work its will.
Mr. Arnosky, please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Don Arnosky. I work for the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, and I'm representing Clean Energy Minnesota. In your packet, there is a handout from Clean Energy Minnesota, and you'll notice at the bottom the 13 organizations that make up a coalition of groups that are working on the next generation of energy for Minnesota. Today, I just want to make a few points for your benefit, and then we can get on to the experts that we brought in from a variety of places. We brought a big thinker, David Morris. We brought a person who's interested, and his organization is interested in a very simple conversion technology, thermal conversion or burning of biomass for energy. And we brought a person who is taking what I would call the next tier of conversion technology, gasification. So you'll be hearing from those three people shortly. What is before us today here in Minnesota is a decision about whether we're going to step forward and lead or whether we're going to follow. Minnesota is a net energy importer, and that means we're a net dollar exporter when it comes to our energy dollars. I believe we're in the least advantageous position across the nation. That's what I've heard in terms of that, if we think of our borders as a trade balance border kind of thing. We need to import a lot of energy. We have an opportunity to turn that around and to seize the interest and the investments that will be flowing in this country to move forward with cellulosic ethanol production and cellulosic energy production. And we can capitalize on some of the research, some of the cutting-edge leading research that has been done by University of Minnesota institutions if we move forward today. What this bill does is really three things, as Representative Aaron Peterson explained to you. Number one is it works with farmers to establish at least pilot-scale plantings of what we believe to be the types of plantings that will help us both agriculturally in terms of diversifying agriculture and diversifying our land base, will help us ecologically in terms of cleaning up our water and providing wildlife habitat, and because the bill has strong incentives for producers that are locally owned and locally controlled, we believe will have added local economic impact by having local ownership of at least a part of this emerging industry. We don't pretend that this bill is going to control everything. This is an incentives bill. This is not a regulatory bill. So this is about setting the benchmark and trying to establish a very high standard with a lot of public returns, a lot of public value as we develop this next generation of fuels and energy for our country. What we are proposing here today is that we would have steps or tiers, in other words, higher incentives for either producers or farmers or energy manufacturers that are accomplishing more public good. And if you take a look at some of the tiers that we have in the bill, we're proposing different tiers of incentive payments. We're proposing different tiers of payments to farmers, for example, depending on what they're willing to sign up for. We'd be happy to explain that in more depth if anybody would like to go into it. But I just wanted to say that this is, just wanted to summarize it for your benefit and say that this, we really are at a critical time in terms of making a decision to move forward and revitalize our rural economies and capitalize on the research we've done and draw a lot of investment into our state, much like Minnesota did 12 or 14 years ago when the corn ethanol industry was not believed in by many people in Minnesota, moved forward and seized that opportunity. And if you look at a map of corn ethanol platforms around the country, they're definitely centered in the upper Midwest, and Minnesota has a lot of that investment. With that, I'll leave my remarks so that you can hear from the other folks unless there are any questions.
Well, would you prefer to hear questions now, or would you like to wait to the end? How about if we wait to the end?
However you want.
Is that okay?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, my name is David Morris. I'm Vice President of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, which is based in Minneapolis and Washington, D.C., and I've worked on biomass policy, related policy, for 25 years at the federal and state level. I was appointed to the Minnesota Ethanol Commission when such a commission needed to exist in the late 1980s, and from 2000 to 2006, I served on a congressionally created advisory council to the Departments of Energy and Agriculture. I was appointed by the Secretary of Energy under President Clinton and reappointed by the Secretary of Energy under President Bush. And I'm delighted to speak in favor of this bill, especially in front of this committee, because I think that the bill reflects and ushers in the next phase in the evolution of biosciences from its incubation in the late 1970s in medical applications to its rise to maturity in manufacturing applications and now to its use in fuels and bioproducts. And I think we have a very good example in our own backyard. In the early 1980s, polylactic acid had a commercial use. It was used for biodegradable sutures for use in surgeries, and the cost was $200 a pound. But you only used less than an ounce in the surgery, and as a cost item in the surgery, it was almost disappeared. And the amount of agricultural material needed to make the world supply of polylactic acid was probably no more than 20 or 30 acres. Today, in 2007, Cargill produces polylactic acid not from milk sugars but from cheaper corn sugars, and the cost is under a dollar a pound. And it has very broad applications from textiles to containers to car bodies. And in the near future, we could see polylactic acid and its other biochemical brethren creating a market for hundreds of thousands of acres of agricultural feedstock. Now, that's an example where technology drove the price down. We have a more recent example in the last couple of years where we see that the price of the competitor suddenly soared, and that, of course, is the price of oil. But when the price of oil hit $60 a barrel a few months ago, corn ethanol became competitive without any incentives. On the other hand, what then happens is that the price of corn goes up. But when the price of corn goes up to $4.25 a bushel, cellulosic ethanol becomes competitive with corn ethanol. Problem is that you don't have any cellulosic ethanol plants now operating 24/7, 365 days out of the year, but you will soon. So because of a combination of political and economic and technological factors, we're shifting. We're in the process of shifting our raw material base from non-renewable to renewable materials, and this committee knows that in electricity that means wind
and sunlight. But if we need physical products, if we need molecules, we're going to choose either minerals or vegetables. And we're going to continue, I think, increasingly to choose vegetables over minerals, biology over geology. And I call that a movement into the carbohydrate economy. And when that happens, a number of different things happen differently in agriculture. For example, for centuries, plants have been bred to maximize a specific component of the plant, either sugar content or protein content or oil content. But today we're beginning to breed plants to achieve two objectives. One is the maximization of mass, that is the amount that you can grow per acre. We can then use the technology to convert that mass into thousands of end products. And the other is to minimize adverse environmental impacts, that is to cultivate massive amounts of plant matter on a sustainable basis. So to oversimplify, we're moving into the age of cellulose, which is by far the world's most abundant living chemical. Both Congress and the White House, that is both the Republican and Democratic Party, support a massive increase in the federal biofuels mandate, which will force us to move from corn-based ethanol to cellulosic-based ethanol and diesel, for that matter, within the next 5 to 10 years. Congress has also ordered the government to as a priority, purchase bioproducts in its procurement process. Now, Minnesota is well poised to take advantage of these new developments. We're among the nation's leaders in the agricultural sciences. We were the first state to displace 10% of our gasoline with biofuels. And in my mind, equally important, we were the first state to design policies to encourage farmers to own the biorefineries that convert their low-value raw material into a higher-value end product. In fact, the farmer ownership model for the biofuels industry is known throughout the world as the Minnesota model. And several of these farmer-owned facilities right now are beginning to replace their primary fuel, that is natural gas, with cellulosic materials. Several are experimenting with new technologies to convert the cellulose not only into fuels, but into higher-value industrial chemicals. The state has several thousand acres of fast-growing trees, and the University of Minnesota is a recognized leader in the breeding of new products, new crops, and in the use of mixed prairie grasses for new materials. So the bill before you moves us into that next stage. Has been indicated by Representative Peterson. It has provisions that encourage farmers to cultivate and harvest increasing amounts of cellulosic materials in ways that minimize soil erosion and fertilizer use and maximize the buildup of soil carbon. It marries the incentives for increased cultivation with incentives for increased use of the cellulosic material to displace fossil fuels, to power the biorefineries in the short term, and to displace corn and supersede corn as the primary feedstock for ethanol production in the longer term. By the end of this year, we will have 5 cellulosic ethanol plants operating in this country. They will be pilot plants. But there is, in law right now, a mandate for 250 million gallons of cellulosic ethanol by 2013. You're all aware that there's a 7.5 billion gallon biofuels mandate by 2012. Most people are not aware that there's a carve-out for 250 million gallons for cellulosic ethanol in 2013. Major chemical companies like DuPont are significantly restructuring their research direction to focus on biochemicals and bioproducts. So the carbohydrate economy is coming, and I think this bill ensures that Minnesota farmers and businesses will benefit from that development. And happily, I think it also extends the strategy of Minnesota encouraging an ownership structure that keeps the money local. My organization did an analysis, and a dollar that Minnesotans spend on gasoline, 75 cents of that dollar leaves the state. Now, that gasoline, by the way, is refined inside of the state. But yet, 75 cents on that dollar leaves the state. 75 cents on the dollar that you spend for ethanol in your fuel tank, if that ethanol is made by a locally owned ethanol refinery, stays within the state. So we're talking about a bill here that can create jobs, tax revenues, intellectual property, which itself becomes a major export for Minnesota, and can improve Minnesota's competitiveness as the world moves toward a carbohydrate economy. So I thank you for listening.
Thank you, Ms. Morris.
Mr. Chair.
Why don't we get the last testifier in, unless it's a question?
It's just an observation while the next testifier is coming,
okay.
If I may.
Go right ahead.
So I don't have a question as such, but, excuse me, I am a believer in better living through chemistry. It's the only reason I'm here this morning, I guess. But as we've put a point here, and just for this Brothers Committee's consideration, we've heard a lot of talk in several of the bills that have come forward in this legislative session in various committees about our borders and about products that we have to buy outside the state and about money moving back and forth. Like somehow that's an evil thing that should be struggled against. And I think it might be helpful for some of us, for all of us actually, to maybe have an economist that speaks maybe to our level. Come in and just have a brief discussion or give and take about just what this means, what the purpose of money is, how it moves, what the United States of America is all about with the prohibitions in the Constitution against one state restraining trade in another state, and so on and so forth. We have a gentleman coming up right now, in fact, I think, who's very glad that St. Louis, for instance, has a severe shortage of barley malt, and that we have a surplus of it because we send trainloads of it down the river, and I think that's a good thing. We have an abundance of corn, and the rest of the world eats our corn. I think that's a good thing. We don't have any coal or oil here. Is that necessarily an evil thing? I don't think so. But we continually have this raised as a reason we should be doing something here. The Institute on Local Self-Reliance, I love the name here, because I think in the global scheme of things, I'm curious as to how local we should strive to get. Do I want my 3 acres and chickens and a windmill and a goat so I can be entirely independent of everybody else around this table? Well, I guess if I want to live that way, at one time, thousands of years ago, that's what we did. We grew our own stuff. We killed our own stuff. We dug our own latrine. I think that as society's evolved, it's become okay to buy our sewer services from the Metropolitan Council and to pay somebody else to drill my well, to buy my car from somebody in Michigan, to drink my beer from somebody in St. Louis, even though they have to buy their barley malt from somebody in Shakopee. I'm just being philosophical here, man. As we think about these bigger picture things, before we rush to undo it all, we may just want to step back and have somebody walk us through how the economy works and why it works as well as it does and how it's given us the standard of living that has never been equaled in the history of the world. Thank you.
Well, Representative Beard, my teenage daughter, my now 20-year-old daughter can tell you the economy. Dad, you make the money. Dad, you give me the money. It's pretty simple.
Exactly.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bob McLeady. I'm with Rahr Malting Company in Shakopee, Minnesota. I'm part of a group that has put together an energy consortium with called Coda Energy. It's a combined heat and power plant that we're building on our property at Rahr Malting Company in Shakopee. Our partners are the Mdewak and Sioux community, and both of the two parties are longtime families. Rahr Malting Company is a privately owned company that generates about one-third of the malting barley necessary to make beer in the United States. Our plant in Shakopee is the largest plant in the world. The Sioux community are looking for long-term energy, clean energy. We got together because Rahr Malting Company has a significant need for energy. Why an energy plant in Shakopee? To stay in business, typically. We make malted barley. We didn't want to get in this business, but the high volatility of natural gas and electricity as we're looking forward in the future, we need some way to control our costs. Plants are moving to North Dakota, Montana, and Canada, where they have other opportunities better than what we have in Minnesota in controlling those costs. We import most of the natural gas that we consume in our plant from Canada, and that's 1.25 million cubic feet of gas per year. That's at a cost of anywhere in the last few years from $5 million to $12 million. A few years ago, that cost was an insignificant part of our portfolio. Today it's over 50% of our operating costs, electricity and natural gas. We're looking at, of course, natural gas generating electricity in our state. Very clean power. It's wonderful. It's environmentally sound, except that it's going to be a little higher price, and for competing energy sources around the world, that's going to be tough.
I just see somebody saying the same thing I've been saying for a few years.
We have the perfect place in Minnesota to have combined heat and power. We use a tremendous amount of electricity. We use a tremendous amount of thermal to dry our product. We were looking for something environmentally sustainable, something in the biomass area where we could buy energy crop, move it in, grind it up, and burn it. And we're investing, obviously, in our future. We generate about 50,000 tons of 170,000 tons of the fuel that we will be using when we start our plant in the spring of 2008. We generate that at our own plant by cleaning the grains that we bring in. We're going to buy about 60 to 90,000 tons from a local processor in within 30 miles of our facility. And again, these plants are generating product 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, so there is a consistent supply of fuel. We're looking beyond that, beyond some wood products. We're looking at a closed-loop system where we could generate one-third of our fuel by switchgrass or native grasses or other means that we could harvest in areas that are, not as sustainable for agriculture. We've done projects along the Minnesota River and the Cottonwood River in New Ulm where we planted native wild grasses to mitigate a floodplain environment, and we've had tremendous success. We were the first company in the United States to trade credits through the EPA and the MPCA to put in our own wastewater treatment plant. And again, I say to you, are we in the wastewater treatment plant business? Absolutely not. The only reason we got into the wastewater treatment plant was because of cost, to control our costs. We put a very clean product back into the river, much cleaner than the river, unfortunately. What this will do, though, by the planting of these native grasses and switchgrasses in areas where there are flood issues, is control that environment. And it's a great testimony to it. And if you would go to New Ulm, you could see those acreages that we have planted in native wild grasses to attest to that. It's actually built up soil along the river. And, of course, it filters when it does flood. Our energy plant will generate about 16.5 megawatts of energy. That's enough for 16,000 homes 24/7. It will also generate about enough natural gas to fuel 11,000 homes in Minnesota. That's not in Florida. That's in Minnesota, where we run those furnaces fairly regularly in the winter. We will need about 170,000 tons of fuel. Again, I've already accounted for more than two-thirds of it. Obviously, for this project, we've accounted for 100%, but we would like to use the switchgrass, and we do have some acreage that we intend on planting switchgrass as experimental to use in our process. This, we believe, is an excellent opportunity for Minnesota to move forward in the energy business. I've heard the speaker before me talk about the advantages. I certainly can't attest to it. I'm a maltster. I make malted barley for the brewing industry. I'm not a professional, an energy person as well. But I can tell you that this bill will promote the development of the state's biofuel infrastructure. We need depots. We need somebody to get this started in the state so that we can move forward. We're not asking for money to build our plant, although we would love for anyone to come forward with it. But we are here to say that it's an opportunity to move the infrastructure forward, and that's why we ask for your support. This will have a significant impact on Coda Energy, our facility. By the way, our facility is a $60 million investment. We'll have a payroll of about $1 million a year. Pardon me. And it will preserve the 130 positions that we have at RAR, and it will also add to the 2,500 jobs that are at Mystic Lake Casino with the Indian community. We will create new jobs. It will keep the money in Minnesota for the most part. We won't be sending our check to Canada to buy our natural gas. We hope to keep it in Minnesota with everything that we do. The energy crops themselves will sequester carbon. There's a tremendous opportunity for us to save on CO2 with a trading environment. CODIS generation of steam from biomass will reduce CO2 emissions by 70,000 tons per year by replacing the natural gas, and 190,000 tons per year versus the coal-fired electricity. It's a tremendously environmental opportunity, and I ask for your support for the bill.
Thank you. Hopefully you're going to be able to stick around and get some questions after. I think there's one more testifier.
Excuse me.
Did you?
I'll wait till the end.
It's an interesting project. It's one that, I don't know what's wrong with Representative Peterson. Generally, you can never shut him up on the floor. You never mentioned your deal. So, thank you very much. And Representative Beard, just so you know, I've been thinking as he was talking about economics. Are you sure you really want me to pick the bad economist?
I have a few suggestions.
I'm a guy who had Gene Debs put on posters in my house.
Silly.
Okay, if you'd read your name in for the record, please, and begin your testimony.
Yes, good morning. My name is Lowell Rasmussen. I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor for Physical Plant and Planning at the Morris Campus, University of Minnesota. Thank you for inviting me here today. I would start my presentation by simply indicating that Representative Peterson wanted to make sure that we are regarded as forward-thinking. I would suggest that the state of Minnesota has been forward-thinking, and as evidence of that, in 2005, you passed a bonding bill that included a biomass research and demonstration facility for the University of Minnesota located at the Morris campus. That was a partnership with the Extension WestRock IREE. And I'm happy to say at this point, I think that investment that you made a commitment to in 2005 is about to pay dividends for the state of Minnesota. We have over the last year and a half essentially selected a process to use for gasification of biomass, and gasification is a thermal conversion process also. It is different than solid fuel combustion. We think it allows more flexibility, especially when you're dealing with high mineral content biomass fuel stocks. We have selected that platform, and with Regents' approval in May, we will start construction of this facility in June, and by next year at this time, it should be operating. So we think the timing of the bill that Representative Peterson has is excellent for the relationship of where we are in the progress of looking at biomass for energy production. I think, as you heard the speaker just before me, that the thermal conversion of biomass certainly is a viable option. The University of Minnesota is looking at this in a smaller scale. We're looking at it as a potentially the kind of a thermal process that small industries throughout the state would look at as an option for replacing their fossil fuel systems. The research that we've done on the gasification, as I said, we've gasified 65 tons of corn stover on three different gasification platforms. The emissions data comes out better than most fossil fuels. A key part of one of the goals and objectives of this project is, and I've heard this word several times this morning, sustainable. What we want to demonstrate is that there is a biomass system that not only can produce energy, but also provide the ash, keep the nutrients in the ash. And so gasification allows us to keep those bed temperatures lower so that we keep the minerals that are coming in a granular form so that they can be reapplied back out into the crop streams. So capturing those minerals and reusing them is a critical part of why we're looking at gasification. The plant at Morris, when it's running, will offset approximately 8,000 tons of CO2. It's greenhouse gas neutral. And I'll let the economists debate about where the issues of the money should be, but I think I can tell you right now that we will redistribute about $500,000 of money that we spent on natural gas will now be redistributed within a 20-mile radius of Morris. We think that the economic driver of that is significant. We are moving into, I think, what Mr. Morris called was the carbohydrate economy, and we think that this kind of project, as a template paired with the House 589 bill, is a perfect match, and we would encourage you to support it. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a lot of interesting things. There are some questions that people had, and I think Representative Norton had one.
Thank you, Chair Mahoney, and I'm not sure which testifier. Maybe I'll just
throw it out there.
Well, I have two issues, and one before, if we're going to have an Economics 101 class, I'd like to invite the Rochester Chamber, because their initiative this year is by Rochester. With regard to the bill at hand, I had two issues, really. One is there seems to be a significant number of initiatives, both bills we've heard before, conversations we've had at this table about funding requests for other initiatives with regard to biofuels. So I'm interested to know not only what kind of communication I really want to spend money in this area, but I don't want to double fund things. So I just want to make sure we're using our money in the best way. So if you'd address that, and also I know in Rochester we have an vegetable oil refinery being proposed right now, and there's some safety issues that the community has with that. But what are you doing? I know there was one testifier who talked about how this is impacting his business. Is there a way to communicate with these other new refineries that are coming to deal with either vegetable oil or cellulose refineries to make sure that you're including them all? Those were my first questions, and I know there's more than one there. But how do you get from the experimental to production stage involving the universities, other research, and other refineries? And then my second question really is for you, Representative Peterson. It had to do with your comment early on about the matching funds with federal dollars, but it sounded like it was still a maybe. If we approve this bill as it's written, can it stand on its own without the federal matching dollars? Those were the two questions I had.
I'll start with the last one first, Mr. Chair, to Representative Norton. I guess it could start out on its own. I think that the next federal farm bill will have my assumption is it'll have some appropriation. I don't know if it'll be out of the commodity title or if it'll be energy appropriations or what. But I think there's enough appetite to if you're authorized to have a standard for 250 million gallons by 2013 of non-corn ethanol, then hopefully you'll be appropriated some from the federal treasury to help get there without just taking all the risk yourself in the market. What this bill is proposing, and simply put, is that the payments for corn ethanol are going down. This desire to keep that amount or line or however it's structured in the biofuels, segment at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. So, yeah, it could go on its own at a level, but if we want to be very aggressive in the states, we could lobby our members of Congress for some additional resources, similar to how we fund transportation in America.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Norton, as it happens, the chairs of both the Senate and House Ag, Finance, and Policy Committees have already started that lobbying. This is a letter that they sent a month ago to Representative Colin Peterson, who is the chair of the House Agriculture Committee at the federal level and is in charge of writing that farm bill. They've also sent it to our other representatives. Our two senators and an additional representative sit on the Agriculture Committees. So they have started that dialogue, and it's been a very receptive audience. They have traveled to Washington at least once that I know of, again, to carry this dialogue through. So we do see an opportunity for Minnesota not only to be a leader in its own right, which we think this bill stands on its merits in its own right, but we see a direct communication and a receptivity at the federal level to work with us, and perhaps that Minnesota model that was referred to in terms of local ownership of the first generation of ethanol will have additional features as the Minnesota model moves forward at the federal level. But even without success at that level, we believe it's very important to capitalize on the investments that have been made in research here in Minnesota. Start out with our own. We believe the $20 million that is proposed for funding through bonding for plantings, that would do approximately 10,000 acres, which is an order of magnitude above, or two orders of magnitude even above, the levels of plantings that we've seen to date. So it's a very important step in terms of taking the research, the technology, and moving it up and making a mark on the national stage that Minnesota's serious about this, is putting money down, and is a good partner to work with businesses and researchers and the emerging technology.
Does that answer your question? Part one was, how do you make that complete circle between research and
right.
business?
And how do we encompass some of the businesses that are already beginning?
In fairness to the three or four other people, and the next bill.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, the bill will stimulate the production of energy crops, and that's where we come in, because we're going to be burning that. Other people will be using it for cellulosic ethanol. We're going to be generating steam to produce heat and generate electricity. So as long as the component is out there to get biomass fuels prepared and ready for our marketplace, that's what we're interested in. And someone has to get it moving in Minnesota, and that's what we hope that this bill could do.
If I could bring your question down a little bit closer.
Did I miss it? I'm sorry.
Is there a coalition? Who's talking to who? Are the nonprofits talking to the for-profits and the research talking to the business?
And if I can just tie into that ceremony, when research is being done and there isn't research for new developments, if we're building refineries for something that's currently developed, is it going to be adaptable enough that when these new products are available that you can use the same refineries? Are we going to be here in a few years saying we need a new refinery because there's new biofuels? So I'm just wondering how you're communicating that link, and that was a good explanation. Thank you.
If I may just speak to that issue in terms of the refineries themselves, one thing that is a marvelous space in Minnesota is that we have corn ethanol plants. And if you make cellulose into ethanol, the first step is processing the cellulose, so you break it down into sugars. And after that, it's the same process as corn ethanol is in terms of fermentation and distillation and the like. And when you bring corn into an ethanol plant, you bring in some fiber. And they are increasingly what's called fractionating the animal feed or high protein part, which is the byproduct of making ethanol, and getting more fiber out of it. And so what is almost undoubtedly going to happen in Minnesota is you're going to see cellulosic conversion to ethanol on the front end in relatively small quantities, but that's what you would expect in your first generation of plants, in the front end of a corn to ethanol plant. And when you get the sugars, it will go into the fermentation and distillation facilities of that plant. So you're not talking here about, you know, having to, I mean, these will not be obsolete. They will, in fact, begin to, you'll probably see in the first generation 5% more ethanol will come out of the plant because of the cellulose, and in the second and third generation, you'll begin to see 20, 30, 40% coming out because of cellulose as new cellulosic materials like corn stover come in and then switchgrass.
Thank you, Ms. Dr. Morris. I'm going to actually take a moment to welcome the students from the School of Environmental Studies in Apple Valley, 11th and 12th graders. Welcome to our committee today. We are, if you haven't already figured, we're talking about how we're going to fuel the cars that you buy for your children later on in life. And good. Thank you for being here. And Representative Peterson has been a strong leader in this. This is the Bioscience and Emerging Technologies Committee, so you picked a good committee to stop by. Representative Haas.
Thank you very much. Representative Peterson, prior to this time when we were talking about prairie grasses and switchgrass and all those things, we were talking about controlling the land and the environment, and we would get into areas where you'd actually make rules that there would be no cut zones and those types of things. Now we're talking about it in terms of crops, and we're going to start harvesting this. Are we going to still be able to keep the positive element of the native grasses as it relates to our environmental thinking, or are we going to go down a track where that this is not going to be good for the environment because the crop is going to get harvested and the niches, the little environmental niches are going to get destroyed and we don't know where in the hell we're going with it? I mean, there's something in there that the world needs and I don't know what it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hollis. Yeah, quickly, you can't just double dip into a CRP acre and have an energy acre and you get a carbon credit for it. You know, it's a very good question. You know what? You see what I mean? I think these will be voluntary. There's a technical committee going to be set up. It's not just going to be willy nilly. And it'd be these acres would be for the production of the energy, not going into some of the ones that are already established for wildlife and the like or buffers. But these in tandem and on top of it, cumulatively speaking, in the watershed scale terms, would help benefit, maybe by default, the improvement of working land water quality. But it's not taking, if you will, all the corn in southern Minnesota out of production. That's not the plan either, but it's just also not, changing the mission of the early programs of CRP and RIM in the state for the environment and natural resource benefits.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, one follow-up question. Representative Beard, when I was growing up, we were a very big family and a lot of boys, and we used to play a lot of cards, and we would gamble real wildly within that card game. And then my father explained to that the excitement was because we had figured out that we could make a little bit of money amongst ourselves. And seeing that my brothers didn't play cards that well, I thought the system worked.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have probably two or three questions. Can I?
Could you? Well, we've only got a few more minutes, so why don't you pick the best one of your two, because there's three, because there's two more after you.
Mr. Chair, this is an important issue. I'll try. I'll try to be. Maybe I'll ask a series of them and let them choose from which they want to answer. Representative Peterson, as you know, one of our challenges is always trying to determine which is the best bang for our buck. And we've heard a lot of different proposals, very good proposals, to decide what to fund. And so I'm struggling a little bit about the total cost of this project. So that would be my first question. Talk about how this is going to be funded, what's going to happen down the road, and, tails, that type of thing. So that's kind of a generic question. My sort of overall question is probably a very basic one. I'm a farm girl and need to be educated on this a little bit. But I'm wondering what happens if we don't pass this legislation. What's the worst case scenario? And the reason what I'm getting at is that I'm wondering right now what's the hindrance to this happening now? Is it because it's not cost effective for people to get into this business? Is it because you talked several times about getting this going? I'm wondering why it's not getting going. Is it not cost effective? Why does the state need to step in and to fund this if it seems like if we let the market work, it would be it would be advantageous for folks to get in this. So if you could kind of talk about some of those financial questions, and then specifically, what if we do nothing? What happens? What do you see would happen in this industry 5 years or 10 years down the road? Would it just not go anywhere, or is it still going to happen? Or where would we be at?
And Representative Peterson, seeing how this is not a financial committee, you might pick your question and answer there. But she, knowing Representative Pepin, she may ask it on the floor. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin. I believe Dr. Morris addressed the market dynamics, the pricing of oil, then the following pricing of corn, and then the competitive nature of the cellulose or non-corn feedstock after that, and how it might then become competitive with a government intervention. That's at least what I call it. So if not passed, then what? I spent a lot of time on this issue, and energy issues in general, and if you don't, and if it's not your favorite subject, then I understand, but there's actually a race across America to get there. And we have an opportunity, you know, lots of venture capital is going into the Pacific Northwest and into California and taking on a certain level of risk, but not willing to take on all of it. So with what Dr. Morris said about the pricing dynamics and the supply and demand of oil and corn and then making something else with the third option potentially economically viable, but yet not the private sector, maybe not really wanting to write the check out themselves just yet. This is similar to what we did for corn. And it's a third, you know, piece, if you will, to the corn and soybean rotation in rural Minnesota, where if you ask me, there's plenty of room in parts of rural Minnesota for diversification of the ag-based economy. Now, funding. Yeah, we're using bonding, capital investment, RIM, Reinvest in Minnesota, which we've done for years, and our first is for $20 million, and we will take direction from a technical committee. We're not picking the winner. We're establishing, you know, those who want to use corn stover will get this much of a, you know, incentive for this many years. If you want to go into the perennial grasses, you get more. If you want to do gasification with various biomass feedstocks, you get this many years. If you want to up it to more perennial sources, you get this much more. So, I mean, it is guiding a little bit, but it is not specifically just picking how it's going to be. It's both on the sugar side and the thermal side. It's not just saying we're going to grow millions of acres of grass in Minnesota and it's all going to be made into fuel. We're not saying that.
If you have a quick follow-up, feel free, but make it very quick.
I've got a very slow follow-up question.
Now, then we're going to...
No, I have a quick follow-up.
Because I would have cut you off, you know that.
You're off. My follow-up question relates to the language on page 3, lines 39 to 312, when it talks about the 15 cents per gallon for each gallon of cellulosic biofuel produced at a specific location for 5 years after the start of production. Which brings the thought to me, what happens after the 5 years? My fear is always when you give incentives, especially in small towns or that type of thing, what happens when the incentive wears off? Do you envision that at that point it will be cost-effective enough for producers to produce this, or is this going to have to be extended? Maybe one of the experts could sort of talk about what's the magic about 5 years on this, or if this is just sort of a get started and we might come and look at it again.
And members, in order to give Representative Hansen a fair hearing, because we've asked him to come here, I'm going to cut questioning off after Representative Pepin. And just so you're not mad at me, I'm cutting myself off because I have a question that I wanted to ask Mr. Micheletti. So if you could be brief so we could give the next bill a good hearing.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Pepin, just briefly, this program and this incentive is very much modeled on the initial corn ethanol incentive program, but as you notice, it's shorter and it's smaller. And we're trying to learn from that first experience. There's a lot of folks who've said that 10-year payment is longer than necessary in terms of the existing corn ethanol program. And these are strong supporters and some of the original authors of that. So we're trying to learn from that and recognize that there are some lower threshold technologies that are closer to commercialization that need less of a push to get over the hump. What a producer can do is take a law like this and an incentive that they've registered for to the bank, and they bank it with their banker. So that's calculated as part of their cash flow, part of their loan program. It's understood right up front what they're going to be getting, and whether it's 5 years, 1 year, 10 years, 15 cents, 30 cents, it can be monetized and calculated as a benefit. And so that's what we're doing. We're trying to establish smaller benefits for nearer-term technologies, larger benefits for ones that are a little further out that need a bigger push.
Well, thank you, Representative Peterson. Thank you, testifiers. And I'm sure I can get a hold of you, Mr. McMillan, to get my question answered through Representative Peterson. Members, I'd like to renew my motion, and I hope Representative Burns, you both had questions. I hope you contact them to get your questions answered. And I think it's fair. And members, I'd like to renew my motion to pass House File 589 and move it to Environmental and Natural Resources Policy. All in favor of passing this bill, signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Thank you, Representative Peterson. Thank you, testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hanson, if you could come on down.
While he's coming, if I could just make a comment.
Certainly you can.
Bills like this are pretty important to us, and I think if we had more time to ruminate on them, it would be good for the author and for the people who are benefiting, for all of us. I had a couple of questions that I think they weren't specifically just for my own edification, but for the edification and enlightenment, I think, of all of us around here, because a couple of them I honestly don't know the answer to, and I'd like to ferret out that information. Now, this bill is moving on, but I think it really does the author and the premise that he's after here a disservice when we can't afford the time to give it a full and open hearing. I don't want to go into the negative here, so I'm trying to keep my comments positive. I think everyone around this table has good questions and good input into what's happening, and I think the author benefits also from it because, like the last guy just started, the testifier just started to touch on, we learned from the ethanol experiments of 10, 12 years ago, and I think that some of the benefit of people around this table, other things that we've seen, the whole Coda Energy project in Shakopee, an outstanding example of just a couple of private entities that came together and said, we want to do this. And they did it without any benefit of help or incentive from us. I'm glad they're here, but they had more to contribute to this discussion than we could give it today. So the bill's on its way. I'm sure we'll be visiting it again, and I may have to schedule time to go to the Environment Committee, wherever it's going next, and talk about it further. Also, there are other projects like this that are out there, and I see some serious concerns that we're going to have to visit at some point concerning just how much capacity we have for biomass generation, because these people aren't the only ones that are going to be asking for it. There's some other pretty fantastic technologies and capital that's coming into the state. Oddly enough, it's venture capital from other states, if we'll allow it in here, tongue-in-cheek, of course. But there's fun things going on in this whole area of bioenergy development, and I think it would serve us well if we could have some more dwell time on it. Again, this is not partisan. It's not a reactionary or Luddite response. It's a fascinating and intriguing area for us to spend more time on, and I've overspoken the subject. Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to make that observation, that request, I guess.
And Representative Beard, I fully understand. Unfortunately, my sense of time is estimated at a shorter amount of time than we really needed, and I'll take the blame for that in some respects. And you know, if you've got an idea of what you'd like to hear in this committee, I think I've been very clear that I'm more than willing and open to many different hearings here. I know we lost a few committees yesterday, so people are going to be busier as we get through. But I'm more than open, particularly after deadline, to have some informational hearings, and I'd love to do that and bring people in to have that conversation, because you are absolutely correct. This is a huge investment that the state will be making over the next 10 to 12 years. And if we need to air them out early, I've already been surprised at how many members have come up to me and asked me about questions about the bioindustry, and I suspect you're having the same, all members of the committee are having some of the same people come to them and ask them questions. So, Representative Byrne? Bun?
Thank you, Chair. I just want to say I shared some of Ms. Representative Beard's concerns. I had my hand up actually twice, and I don't think I was even seen that I wanted to ask questions in the last one. And if in the future, if the next bill doesn't necessarily have, I don't see testifiers with it, if we might consider, you know, rescheduling that one so that we could have a longer discussion, because I have some financial questions as well to follow up on regarding that. So thank you.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I have a short bill, so maybe we'll get done earlier.
We only got 15 minutes, so
I'll speak quickly. I represent a district that does not have any agriculture in it except one apple farm. However, my constituents will consume fuel, whether it's made from gasoline or corn ethanol or cellulosic ethanol. And my background, I believe strongly in research. And as I've looked in, you know, the previous bill talked about production of cellulosic ethanol, processing. There's a lot of talk about that. What House File 769 does is it goes back to the original basic step. I've talked with the university and I asked what type of basic research is being done on basic agronomic production of native plants. Do we know what the yield is on 40 acres of switchgrass? Do we know what that yield is from southeast Minnesota to northwestern Minnesota? Do we know how native plants respond to nutrient management or pest management problems? All of those basic agronomic issues, whether they're yield, nutrient response, pest response, varietal response, hybridization, all of those issues, there's very little research that has been done on production scale. What you heard earlier today is taking production scale and processing it. What 769 does is it provides $1 million to the University of Minnesota to fund basic agronomic research into plant breeding, nutrient management, pest management, yield, and viability. In addition to representing first-tier suburbs, I also do have experience growing native plants. I have a farm in southern Minnesota. I have planted mixes of native prairie, whether they're grasses or forbs. It's difficult to get them established. And seeding, rainfall, plant population, all of the things that we've researched in great detail on corn or soybeans, we don't have that data. And so I think before we start we don't have that data on native plants. We have a lot of folks who've been doing native plant plantings. We have the history with the Board of Water and Soil Resources, with RIM, with the federal government, with CRP. And I was given a copy of, back in 1985, there was some native grass specifications. I'm going to pass this booklet around just so folks can look at it. In terms of the type of information we need to provide to landowners so we know what we're doing. We know what that basic background is. And basic research takes a few years to get that data, to get that reproducible data that we can use so that folks who are going to be planting this material know what it does in the field and know how to produce it. So I also handed out a draft copy, and I, with my apologies to the DNR, that I received from Representative Wagenius on local ecotypes. And it gets to some of these issues about rainfall differences, plant material, genetic plant material. We have very little native prairie left in Minnesota, and if we want to reproduce that, we have to be concerned about genetic drift from out of state or out of area genetic material for those plants. Now, for example, if I was going to plant switchgrass on my farm in southeast Minnesota, I should try to get the seed stock for switchgrass from native switchgrass in that part of the state. And so we have some of these remnants, and some of these remnants are on public land, and either in state parks, SNAs, WMAs. So as a state, we may have a resource here. We can work with the University of Minnesota, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, the Department of Natural Resources, to help with this basic research that I believe we need to do as we start talking about alternative fuel sources. So I have that handed to you. There is a technical advisory committee in there. It's my intent that that would include some of the state agencies and local governments that I've discussed. And with that, I will open myself up for questions. I know that the University of Minnesota is here if you have questions as well.
I have actually one question. It's good to get all this information, but what is the plan to disseminate this information once you've gotten it? A case in point is something that I was really surprised at I've been approached by a number of minority communities about building codes and their lack of understanding of how you get permits and licensing. And in trying to figure this out, why they're having difficulties with it, I find out that there's no program, no written information about it across the state. And it's all there. It's cheap to translate it into a couple, three different languages, and you hit 90% of the immigrants or new citizens of the state of Minnesota. What's your vision or your plan for that particular dissemination of information?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think the basic background for the University of Minnesota is the Agricultural Extension Service, which is now the Minnesota Extension Service, or the University of Minnesota Extension Service. So there have been a number of name changes, but you have the traditional delivery system of taking the research and getting out to landowners that used to be primarily agricultural. We still have that mechanism. It has evolved and it has changed over time, and it also has partners that are out there with the myriad of local governments and state agencies that work with landowners. The DNR and the Board of Water and Soil Resources have a Working Lands Initiative that's working with landowners to try to get land into conservation and work on private lands, establishing some of the conservation practices, which often may include native plantings. So I believe that there is an existing delivery system out there, and I want to point out that my experience has been that sometimes folks that are planting this may not be the traditional production agriculture. They may be the folks that are buying 40 acres or 20 acres and are planting a portion of that for wildlife, and could be a source for some of the basic research that's going on as well, in addition to the larger scale 160, 400, 500 acre issues. So the University of Minnesota does have a delivery system. I think it's changed over time, and it's also evolved into working with local governments and nonprofits, whom you've seen here, who work with landowners to try to implement practices.
Representative Beard, the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, thanks for bringing the bill forward. I'm thinking, to follow up on the Chair's question, about things that might be out there that might already have an infrastructure. What about ARI, the Agriculture Utilization Research Institute? I know they've been around for a while and done some pretty good work. Are they strictly row crops, or would it be a platform that could easily be adaptable to this kind of research? And are they connected with, forgive my ignorance, are they connected to the U of M at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, I left the ARI presentation downstairs in the committee. I'm supposed to be able to come up here and testify. But they were talking about some of these things where they were. They just have put a slide up talking about renewable energy and bringing stakeholders together around the table. So working again with some of the same folks that you've been hearing from today. Mm-hmm. ARI is taking a leadership role in some of that next step development, and maybe that's something that the chair could ask for and give an update. They were talking about this very issue when I came up.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just echo, I think, a comment Representative Norton had made a few moments ago. There's a lot of enthusiasm and inertia moving ahead in this. We've heard a lot of bills here, and in other committees I've heard other bills, but we're getting a lot of what appears to be overlap. And in the interest of economizing and making our taxpayer dollars go as far as they can, as effectively as they can, at some point, somewhere, someone's got to make some sense out of this. So I guess what I'm asking is, as your bill moves forward, my encouragement is that you'll be listening for places where it might fit in, or you can pull other things into your orbit so that we can actually streamline this process and not be reinventing the wheel three and four times over.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, I think the good thing to keep in mind with your Biosciences and Emerging Technologies Committee is basic research often isn't sexy. I mean, you look just around the room, it's empty out. Mm-hmm. And if you move from talking about production mm-hmm. versus talking about basic research, and basic research is what we need to be able to move into the applied research to get the economic benefits that we're talking about, that we hope to make our state strong. So I'd encourage you, not just on my bill, but to to be supporting basic research when you can, because it's that fundamental building block that we need when we're looking at applied research and economic development.
Representative Dunn.
Thank you, Chair and Presenter, Representative Hansen. I am quite familiar with higher education type issues and research approaches, and also with the land grant system as well. And generally, I would have thought decisions about, you know, what to pursue for basic research were driven by the faculty at the university generally, and also in the extension system, and their department focuses in terms of where their specialties and those kinds of things. And NEDA plan issues have been around for some time. Something I've been interested in the past, and I'm just a little curious about having to be earmarking something so precisely within this whole range of things. And that I would have thought that either driven by their personal academic interest, or by where the general academic literature is going, or by all these various kinds of new initiatives we're talking about that are going to generate a demand for new kinds of research and interest, that this would evolve in a more synergistic way within the system, and not our saying, you know, we want you to do research on, you know, native grasses with this $1 million. And so I am kind of questioning this approach to provide that, as opposed to our general funding for the university and general funding for land, you know, for the extension programs, that kind of thing, and then letting them make those decisions within that as how to proceed. Could you comment on that, please? Thank you.
Well, Representative Hansen, would you prefer to have the university come down and explain how we how their academic system works? Oh, wait a second. Maybe not.
Go right ahead, Representative. And nod if he's in agreement or take a set of. I think, Representative Bunn, you bring up a very good point, and that I think that the university, they do have their priorities setting. They're a very large institution existed before Minnesota became a state. They set their own priorities. We do provide some funding for them, but I think there's been a tsunami of interest in all these alternative energies. Even in the years since, I mean, in the months since we met, I mean, the volume and the interest and the bill introductions that have occurred relating to energy production, biosource energy production, both at the state level and the federal level. Part of my purpose for introducing this bill is to say, let's wait a second. We're talking about spending tens of millions of dollars on applied and production research. We can't forget about the basic research. I know the university has concerns about earmarking and also one-time money, that it's hard to fund long-term research with a one-time appropriation. But I think as we go through this mix, we have to look at some of this basic fundamental research if we're starting to talk about supplies and production. And Mr. Iverson could comment.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Representative Bunn, I couldn't agree more with Representative Hansen that there has been what I will call a flurry of interest around biofuels, and we do have some very exciting research going on in this area. All of you have heard from Dr. Tillman a couple of times probably by now, and we do get very concerned with direct earmarks at the university, because we see ourselves as a very broad institution that has to do basic research in a number of areas. And when you focus down to as specific an earmark as this, it has a tendency to take away from other areas that research needs to be done in. Representative Hansen and I have had a good conversation about that, and we are in agreement that we will continue to work together as this bill moves forward to hopefully make it a little less prescriptive, perhaps, but to I'm pretty confident that what is going to happen coming out of Representative Junkie's committee over the next week is going to be, in the state ag special, is going to talk about areas of emphasis that the legislature would like to see. And I think that moving in that direction, the university has no problem with looking at areas of emphasis for that the legislature thinks that we should be moving into and looking at our academic or our faculty and saying, with our deans and saying, these are areas that the legislature has interest. Are there folks here that would be willing to look into some of these areas? And we understand we need to be responsive to the citizens. They entrust us with a great deal of their treasure, and we want to be responsive to that, but we also want to be to do it in a way that makes sense from a research perspective as well. So I share your concern about earmarking. We have a very good relationship with Representative Hansen, and I know he means to do no harm, and I know that nobody does at the legislature, the university, and we will continue to work with Representative Hansen and all members of the legislature as we move this process forward. So that was a very long-winded answer that I'm not sure I said a whole lot, but I think you get my drift.
You probably could have just said this is the first of one of many that come this way to the university. Representative Norton, you had a follow-up? I should ask. Did you have a follow-up, Representative Bunn? Representative Norton.
I'd happily defer. I did go to the University of Minnesota tour this summer, and I know there's some very exciting bioscience research going on. At least the investigator was very excited about it. I didn't understand it. I guess I'm struggling with this same concept, and I think you've touched on it, but the university, and I'm sorry I don't understand how the decisions are made at the university for research. You have a myriad of departments, countless, and research happens in most or many of them. And I guess I was looking to see, does the type of action that we've been talking about, which is this particular bill as well as numerous others, hinder or help focus? You kind of alluded to the fact that maybe it's not helpful, and yet with limited research dollars out there, and you have to make sure every single department gets their research done, and I think what we're trying to perhaps do is help by saying this is an area that the state wants to move forward in, but if it's not helpful, I guess I'd appreciate knowing how that happens.
Now, I think you misunderstood a little bit of what I was trying to say, in that getting directed dollars on a one-time basis that says we are going to study this particular plant is not necessarily the most helpful way for the university to move forward, because when we make an investment in a faculty member, it's not a two-year cycle. It is a 20-year cycle based on their ability to not only do that research, but rather their potential to go out and secure federal grants, to secure other private grants, to do a field of study in that area.
So that being different than perhaps an area of research like biodiesel, it's more helpful. Okay. Thanks.
Representative Pepin?
Yeah, I think my question is very similar, Mr. Chair. I think this will help, for me, this will help solidify my vote on this. And my question to you is, where does this research project rate on a scale with your other research projects? Is this number one on your list of priorities? Is it number 200? Is it somewhere in between? And what I'm trying to get at is, to me it seems, I think the Representative Bunn and Representative Norton are sort of on the same wavelength here. I do feel a little uncomfortable deciding for the University of Minnesota where to spend the research dollars, so I'm inclined to vote against this unless you tell me that this is way up on top. University of Minnesota has a lot of great projects. We vote on a lot of things for the University of Minnesota, and I don't want to create a situation where the university wants to go in some direction, but because, you know, we geniuses at the legislature decide this is a better area to go, this is where we want to go. So maybe if you could just sort of, you know, is this a top tier priority, second tier, maybe there's I want to know where we're going to get the best bang for our buck.
And before you answer that, I want the committee to understand that this is a informational hearing and we will not be voting on the bill at all. If you're willing to take a stab at rating something for your deans, have at it. And then I want to send that letter off myself.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Pepin, My position at the university is one to help the university both understand the workings of this building and to help explain the legislative process to our academic folks and create greater understanding with all of you folks. I am nowhere in a position to say what the priorities are for research at the university. I would be happy to get Dr. Mulcahy over here, who is our director or vice president for research, and let him take a stab at that, but I think he might find that difficult as well. So I will defer on that, and we can talk further about these kinds of bills and how they affect us and all of that offline outside the committee hearing. But I think, you know, just not to be flippant, but I think that there is a great deal of excitement, and within the university there's a great deal of excitement about this particular area. So I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Mr. Iverson, that was a good answer for you to give, and I understand why you get paid the big bucks.
Representative Hodge, did you have...
I just had one comment. Remember when the university was here talking about their bioscience and discoveries within plant crops, I asked, would that be inclusive of native crops? And they said, no, we don't do much with native crops.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And maybe we should force them within that study to do more within the considering our native vegetation as a crop if it is going to be a field crop.
Oh, and our crack researcher here gave me a little note that I will share with Representative Hansen about where money can come from and some better other ways that this could be done. And members, as to Representative Beard's and some of the other committee members' questions and concerns about overlap, I think I've seen bio something or another in a bill totaling, closing in on 100. And we could spend 4 to 6 hours a day every week between now and the end of session trying to figure out where the overlap is. I would love to do that because then it would be a really overreaching policy committee that could set something up for the state. It's part of our job as legislators is to do as much of that as we can outside of committee also, and then to go kind of harass and beat up the finance committee member chairs saying that this is a good idea, this is a bad idea, on top of what we're going to do in a couple, 3-4 weeks as we kind of decide what our priorities are that we've heard. I've tried to pick bills that have the biggest impact, but there are an awful lot of other bills out there, and I hope, you know, I actually know that you've been following because some of you have talked to me about other bills. And I strongly recommend that you go to the finance chairs to say these are good ideas or bad ideas, because we see it a lot more than many other committees do. And we're seeing I'm trying to give us a bigger, rounder picture than just the egg or just one little thing. And if you've got a comment quickly, then I'm going to adjourn because we're cutting into our lunchtime.
Sir Mahoney, I just want to thank you for that explanation. Half of this committee are freshmen. Yep. And so we have not experienced the end process to understand how some of that works. So I just ask your patience as we learn the process, and we'll try to learn from your experience as well. Thank you.
Always remember, you got an election certificate. You got as much right to a voice as anyone here. Thank you. With that, members, Representative Hansen, thank you for your presentation. We stand adjourned.